welded together in a way that sometimes shocked him. A phone rang in one of the drawers, broke into his thoughts. He retrieved the phone, answered, said, "Wait." He went to the doorway and heard giggling voices and running water in the bathroom down the hall. Shutting the door, he said, "Talk." "They had Cross dead to rights, and they let him get away." Lizzie's grandfather rubbed at his brow, wanted to break something. "Idiots," he said. "How difficult can it be? He's tough." "Cross is a goddamn threat to everything we've built." "Agreed." He thought several moments, said, "We need to go professional."
"You got a player in mind?"
"Contact that woman we used last year. She'll get it done right."
"She's expensive."
"There's a reason. Let me know." Lizzie's grandfather broke the burned phone and threw it in the trash. Then he left the office and padded down the hall toward the bathroom. With every step, he turned his thoughts toward magical princesses and fairies.
Chapter 48. Belglade, Florida. Early the next morning, Detective Sergeant Pete Drummond drove an unmarked vehicle to the west side of the county, far from the mega mansions and the deep blue sea. Detective Richard S. Johnson looked out the window as they passed what used to be a hospital and what used to be a grocery store and a boarded-up shop that used to sell clothes. Some blocks, there were so many abandoned, windowless buildings pocked with bullet holes, it looked like parts of Afghanistan Johnson had seen serving the Marine Corps. They crossed a canal and took the Torrey Island Road out into agricultural fields south of Pelican Bay on Lake Okeechobee. Cane, mostly, and corn, and celery. Johnson could see people out there picking in the infernal heat. Drummond took a left onto a spur road. A sheriff's cruiser was parked in the turnaround ahead, lights flashing. The county medical examiner's van was parked beyond it. The sergeant climbed out of the rig, and Johnson followed him. Deputy Gabrielle Holland got out of her cruiser, said, "Got her all taped off for you, Sarge. We're just lucky a gator didn't get to her before I did." "You identify her?" Drummond asked. "Francie Letourneau. She's from Belglade. Haitian immigrant. You know her?" Drummond shook his head. "I don't know the Glade like I used to. Nice lady for the most part. Worked over in Palm, cleaning castles." Johnson said, "You were professionally acquainted with the deceased?" "We got Francie on drunk and disorderly a few times, but really she was just blowing off steam."
"You got an address for Ms. Francie here?" Drummond asked.
"I can get it," Holland said. "Please," the sergeant said. "We'll go down and take a look." "You might want your boots," the deputy said as she climbed into the cruiser. Drummond went to the rear of the unmarked and got out a pair of knee-high green rubber boots. The sergeant glanced at Johnson's shiny black shoes, said, "You're going to need a pair of these for work in the west side of the county." "Where do you get them?" Johnson asked.
"Best price is that Cabela's catalog," the sergeant said as he put them on. "But you could pick up something local at the Bass Pro Shops in Dania Beach."
Drummond led the way around the cruiser, behind the coroner's van, and over the bank of an irrigation ditch. Holland had taped off a muddy path that led down to the water. "That's the blackest mud I've ever seen," Johnson said.
"Some of the richest soil in the world," Drummond told him,
skirting the tape through thigh-high swamp grass. Johnson followed. Three steps in, he sank in the mud and lost his shoe.
"Cabela's!"
Drummond called over his shoulder. The young detective cursed, dug out his shoe, and wiped it on the grass before joining the sergeant down by the ditch. Francie Letourneau's body lay face up in the muck, head at the water's edge, feet oriented uphill. Her eyes were open and bulging. Her face looked particularly swollen, and her feet were bare and muddy.
"Cause of death, time of death?"
Drummond called to the assistant medical examiner, a young guy named Kraft, who also wore green rubber boots and stood on a folded blue plastic tarp next to the body. Kraft pushed back sunglasses, said,
"She was strangled 36 to 40 hours ago. Ligature is deep and looks like there's fibers in the wound."
"She's been here in this heat the whole time?" Johnson said.
"I don't think so," Kraft replied. "She was killed somewhere else and dropped here, probably last night. A fisherman found her at dawn.
The sergeant nodded.
She got a phone on her?
Nope, the medical examiner said. Drummond looked around before crouching to study the body from 6 feet back. Then he walked up the bank along the tape and looked at the path and the marks in the mud and the footprints, most of which were filled with murky water. The sergeant gestured to shallow grooves in the mud.
Her heels made those marks, he said. He drags her downhill, holding her under the armpits. Right there where the grooves get smaller, her shoes come off. Killer dumps the body and goes back for the shoes. So why doesn't he push the body into the water?
Johnson said, maybe he meant to, but something spooked him. A car out on the main road. But why take her shoes? A fetish or something?
He didn't take them, Drummond said, gesturing across the ditch. He tossed them. There's one of them hanging on the branch over there.
Johnson frowned, saw the shoe, and said, how'd you see that?
The sergeant said, I looked, detective. They taught you how to do that down in Dade, right?
Chapter 49. An hour later, Drummond and Johnson were back in Belglade and parking in front of the big old bar, which, according to Deputy Holland, was where Francie Letourneau liked to party. The Big O was a dive fallen on hard times. The cement floor was cracked and irregular. The blue paint was peeling and chipped. Most of the chairs, bar stools, and tables had been carved on. The only part of the place that looked remotely cared for was behind the bar. Hundreds of photographs of happy anglers holding up largemouth bass looked down on the four patrons dressed for fishing and the bartender.
Cecil,
the sergeant said. The bartender, an older man with a big pot belly, started laughing.
Drummond, you want a drink? I think you enjoy being my temptation. Hell yeah, Cecil said, coming over to shake the sergeant's hand. Everyone's got a job, right? Amen, brother, Drummond said. Cecil Jones, meet my partner, Detective Richard Johnson, Miami boy.
The bartender shook Johnson's hand, said,
you coming up in the world.
The young detective smiled, said, I like to think so. Jones looked to Drummond and said,
you gonna set him straight? I'm trying, the sergeant said. I heard they found a body out on the island, the bartender said.
Why I'm here, Drummond said.
Francie Letourneau.
Jones's face fell.
Shit. That right? Shit.
She's a regular then.
Not a full-time subscriber, but often enough.
She been in recently?
Sunday round noon, he said, glancing up at the clock. Had herself an eye-opener, Bloody Mary, double vodka, and then another for courage.
Courage?
She was heading over to Palm, Jones said. Said she had an interview for a new job that was going to pay her four times what her old one did. I asked her what she needed a job for after hitting the lotto twice in a month.
That right, Drummond asked.
$5,000 on the scratcher, $7,000 on her weekly play, Jones said.
$12,000 is a lot of money, Johnson said.
It is, the bartender said. But she said she still needed to work. She lost two or three of her regular clients recently. No fault of her own. One got electrocuted in a bathtub.
Drummond said,
let me guess. Another was murdered.
Yeah, that's right, Jones said. Wife of that plastic surgeon you see advertising on television all the time. You know, the boob king.
20 minutes later, they pull up in front of Francie Letourneau's small apartment with renewed purpose. The now-dead maid had worked for two now-dead wealthy women from Ocean Boulevard. Ruth Abrams' death was clearly a murder by strangulation. Now Drummond and Johnson were questioning whether Lisa Martin really had accidentally dropped the Bose radio in her bathtub. Had she been killed too? They got the landlord to open the maid's apartment, stepped inside. Johnson gagged at the smell coming from a makeshift altar in the corner. A rooster's severed head had been placed upright in the dead center of a tin pie plate. 2 inches of chicken blood congealed and rotted around the head. The bird's feet were there too, set with their talons facing a doll made of bound reeds, stuffed burlap, and corn husks. A long thorn of some sort jutted out of the doll's groin. There were two more thorns in the heart. A fourth one penetrated the top of the head.
Santeria, Drummond grunted. She must not have left it behind in Port-au-Prince.
Who's the doll supposed to be? Johnson said.
Let's figure it out, the sergeant said.
They searched for almost an hour. In a manila envelope on a small desk, Johnson found receipts from the prior month for a new couch, television, and Cuisinart food processor. In the top drawer, he found the receipt for the Apple MacBook Pro that was still in the box on the floor next to the filing cabinet. Everything had been bought with cash. The lower filing cabinet drawer was partially open. One file had been shoved in hastily and it jutted above the rest. Johnson pulled it and saw that the day before Letourneau died, she'd bought a brand new phone and upgraded her plan through Verizon. Johnson called the number, heard it go straight to voicemail. He made a note to pull her phone records. Drummond returned after searching the bedroom.
Anything?
He asked. She spent a lot the past month, Johnson said.
All cash.
I figure close to 4,000. I looked at her bank accounts. There's no 8 grand and no record of a safe deposit box.
Well, she wasn't keeping it under her mattress, Drummond said. I've been over every inch of this place. Both bedrooms, kitchen, all of it. And
Johnson looked at the sergeant. He had stopped talking and was fixated on the altar and the doll.
Maybe Ms. Francie was craftier than we thought, Drummond said, walking over.
Maybe she left that chicken blood there knowing it would reek, and the voodoo stuff knowing it would freak out anyone who might break into her house looking for cash. He lifted the maroon cloth, revealing the legs of a folding card table, the carpet, and nothing more. Good thought, though, Johnson said. Drummond got down on his knees, reached under the card table, and said,
You give up too easy, Miami.
The sergeant worked his fingers into the carpet and ripped up a 1x2 foot section that had been held in place with Velcro strips. He got out a jackknife and pried up an edge of the floor. Drummond reached in, came up with a black leather purse, and eased out from under the voodoo altar. He stood up, brought the purse over to the desk, and opened it. The sergeant whistled, shook his head, said,
Francie,
what did you get yourself into? Johnson peered into the purse.
If those are real, Sarge, there's a lot more than 8 grand in there.
Chapter 50. Starksville, North Carolina. Sharon Lawrence held up well under Naomi's initial cross-examination. She stuck to her story about Stefan drugging and raping her, and being so afraid of him she didn't report it until after he was under arrest for Rashawn Turnbull's murder. You have a lot of girlfriends, Sharon? Naomi asked. The girl nodded. Enough. Best friends forever? A couple, sure. You tell any of them you were going to Coach Tate's house that afternoon you say he raped you? No, it was supposed to be a secret. Anyone see you around his house? I don't think so, Lawrence said. He had me sneak in through the basement from the alley bulkhead door. Sitting behind Naomi with Bree holding my hand, I tried to stay focused on the testimony and listen for discrepancies. But my ribs hurt and my mind kept drifting to the evening before. Janny and my grandmother had already gone to bed by the time Pinky dropped me off. Bree and I are tight. She knew in an instant that something was wrong with me, beyond a couple of cracked ribs. I'd repeated Pinky's story, and she was as shocked as I was. Are you going to tell Nana Mama? Bree asked. That question had kept me up most of the night. It was still bothering me in court that next morning. So was the fact that Patty Converse had not shown up. And I think several of the jury members had noticed. Then Naomi said,
Ms. Lawrence, did you see Rashawn Turnbull at Coach Tate's house that afternoon?
I forgot about the night before and Stefan's fiancée and focused. It was the first I'd heard about the victim being at the alleged rape scene. I glanced over at Cece, who was sitting beside a pretty blonde woman in her late 30s. Two rows behind Cece sat her parents and a young woman I didn't recognize. But they all seemed as interested as I was. Lawrence said, No,
I did not see Rashawn there. Why? Because Coach Tate says the only person at his home after school that day was Rashawn Turnbull. The high school senior looked doubtful. I don't know anything about that. What time did you leave? Lawrence shrugged. I don't know exactly. 4? Maybe 5? I was still kind of groggy. Went out through the basement to the alley? That's right. Strange, Naomi said, looking at a couple of pieces of paper. I have a sworn statement here from Sydney Fox that says she remembers Rashawn Turnbull knocking on Coach Tate's door around 4 that afternoon. She remembers Rashawn going inside. Delilah Strong jumped up. Objection, Your Honor. Sydney Fox is dead and cannot be questioned. I'd like to move that her statement be inadmissible. This goes to the witness's credibility, Judge, Naomi said. Varney thought about that for a moment and then said, Overruled. Your Honor, Strong cried.
I said overruled. Ms. Cross, can you rephrase as a question?
Naomi nodded, said, Are you sure you didn't see Rashawn? Lawrence frowned, looked around, seemed to seek someone out in the courtroom, and said, I don't remember. I was groggy. Maybe he was there. Or maybe you weren't there at all, Naomi said.
That's not true. Why would I lie about something like this?
That's what I've been trying to figure out, Naomi said. Your parents here today, Sharon? Lawrence looked into the courtroom again, said, My mom. My father's not around anymore. The pretty blonde woman sitting with Cece Turnbull craned her head to see better. And who is your mom? Ann Lawrence. What was her maiden name?
Objection, Strong said. Where's the relevance?
Naomi said, I'm about to show relevance, Your Honor. Varney nodded, but I noticed he had gone pale since he entered the courtroom. Your mother's maiden name?
King,
she said. Anne King. She have a sister? Lawrence looked uncomfortable, said.
I don't see yes or no.
Yes, Louise was her sister. She's dead. And who was Louise married to at the time of her death? The girl's jaw seemed to tense a bit before she said, Marvin Bell. That got my attention, and I sat up straighter. So did Bree. So Marvin Bell is your uncle, Naomi asked.
Yes.
Has your uncle provided you and your mother with financial support since your father left? Naomi asked.
Objection, the prosecutor cried. What is the relevance here? Mr. Bell has no connection whatsoever to this case.
With the court's indulgence, I'm trying to establish that connection, Naomi said.
You're on a short leash, counselor,
Varney said, sweating now despite the fact that it was quite cool in the courtroom. Naomi said, Marvin Bell has been giving your family money, correct? She lifted her chin, said,
Yes.
Be tough without that money, wouldn't it? I noticed Sharon's mother had gone very tense. She was sitting forward, holding on to the back of the bench in front of her.
Yes, Lawrence said quietly.
Tough enough that you would lie about a rape if he asked you?
No,
she said, and then she reached across herself with her left hand to scratch her shoulder, in effect shielding her heart. You realize you're under oath, Naomi said. And you understand the penalty for perjury in a capital crimes case?
No, I mean, yes.
Objection, Your Honor, Strong said. The defense is badgering the witness.
Sustained, Varney said, patting his brow with a handkerchief.
Naomi paused and then said, Did Coach Tate ever come to you asking about your uncle, Marvin Bell? Lawrence looked confused. If he did, I don't remember.
Funny, Naomi said, returning to the defense table. We talked to Lacey Dahl, a good friend of yours, correct?
Yes. Miss Dahl would testify that she heard Coach Tate ask you about Marvin Bell a few days before you claim the rape occurred, Naomi said. She heard it outside the woman's locker room at the high school. Do you remember now? Lawrence fidgeted.
I don't know, maybe.
What did he ask about?
I don't remember.
Did he ask whether your uncle was involved in the drug trade in Starksville?
What? Lawrence said, offended. No! That never...
Before she could finish, Judge Varney let out a howl like he'd been stabbed. His contorted face turned beet red, and his entire body went rigid. Then he moaned like a wounded animal and pitched forward onto the bench.
Chapter 51.
3 days, I said later that afternoon, standing outside the track stadium at Starksville High School with Bree. We were talking to Naomi with my cell phone on speaker. Maybe 5, my niece replied. Judge Varney's riddled with kidney stones, and passing too. Strong says resuming trial Friday is the best we can hope for, but more likely Monday. It's probably a blessing, Bree said. Why's that? Naomi asked. I said, unless you and Stefan aren't telling us something, Bree and I have both looked at the evidence, and other than Stefan's suspicions about Marvin Bell, we don't see anything that links him to drug trafficking. There's circumstantial evidence, Naomi said.
That's not good enough, Bree said. We need to prove it.
I said, if we can peg Bell as a drug lord, threatened with exposure, suddenly his niece Sharon's story feels dubious, and we have a strong motive for his framing Stefan.
Still leaves the DNA evidence, Bree said.
I think I've got that covered, Naomi said. Stefan and Patty used condoms. I've got an expert witness willing to testify that it is entirely possible that the semen found on Rashawn and on those panties was stolen from the trash and then planted.
Put both those things together, and there's your reasonable doubt, I said.
But we don't have Bell, Bree said. And Patty Converse, a no-show in court today, didn't help.
I'm on my way to her apartment, Naomi said. She's not answering her phone.
Let us know, I said, and I hung up. We went into the stadium and climbed into the stands. Many of the same athletes from the other day were there, including Sharon Lawrence, who shot Bree and me a glare as she jogged past with several of her friends. Bree said, the other night Cece Turnbull said Rashawn was very upset about something in the days before he died.
I remember that, I said.
Would seeing a rape be upsetting enough? She asked quietly. I looked over and saw she was serious.
It would be upsetting enough, I said.
Was Stefan's version of events all lies? Had Rashawn seen him with Lawrence? Had my cousin assaulted the boy to shut him up?
Janny was again running with the older girls. Coach Green had them skipping in 200-meter intervals.
I couldn't remember Janny ever doing that in a training session, and I noticed she was having difficulty staying with the college athletes. When it was over, Janny went to her bag, threw on a hoodie, and then came over to the fence with an unhappy expression.
I suck at skipping, she said. I don't know why I'm doing it.
Did you ask? I said.
Janny shrugged, said, it's supposed to help with your explosiveness.
There you go, Bree said.
I'm plenty explosive when it counts, Janny said.
Couldn't hurt to get more, I said, noticing that Coach Green was crossing the track toward us, carrying Janny's gym bag and looking serious.
Dr. Cross, she said, not looking at Janny, we have a problem.
How's that? I said, standing. She held out Janny's bag by the handles. It was open.
Janny frowned, tried to see what the coach was talking about as I climbed down, but Green held it away from her, said, I want your father to see first.
I stepped up and looked in the bag. There, nestled in a wrinkle of Janny's sweatpants, was a small glass vial filled with white powder.
Chapter 52.
That's not mine, Janny protested the second she saw it. Dad, there is no chance that's mine. You know that, right?
I nodded.
Someone put that in her bag.
Who would do that? Coach Green asked. And why?
I looked over at Sharon Lawrence, who was stretching and talking with her friends, seemingly oblivious to what was happening across the track.
I can think of someone, but I'll let the police deal with that, I said.
You want me to call the police?
You touch it?
Green shook her head.
Then yes, call the police. It's easily proved whether it's my daughter's or not, I said. Either her fingerprints are on it or they're not.
The coach looked at Janny.
Are they?
No way, Janny said. Was the bag open? I asked. The bag was open, Janie said. I got my hoodie out and came over.
Was that how you saw it, Coach? I asked.
Eliza Foster, one of my athletes at Duke, noticed it and called me over.
So it was put in there either before practice or right after Janie put on her hoodie and came over to talk to me, I said.
Eliza would have no reason to do anything like that, Green said.
I want there to be concrete evidence that this was absolutely not my daughter's.
Janie will even provide a blood sample that you can drug test, right?
Janie nodded.
Anything, Dad.
I got out my wallet, dug out a business card, and handed it to the coach.
Call this guy, Sheriff's Detective Guy Petalini. He'll handle the situation correctly.
Green hesitated, but then nodded. She walked away with Janie's bag, punching in the phone number on her cell phone. Janie looked about to cry when she sat down beside me and Bree.
You'll be fine, I said, hugging her.
Why would someone put that there? She asked, looking torn up.
To get at me and Bree, through you, I said.
But it won't work.
Detective Petalini showed up 10 minutes later. I let him speak with Green first, waiting patiently with Janie and Bree. He put on gloves and bagged the vial. He nodded to me and then went to talk with Eliza Foster. When he was done, he came over and shook my hand in the twilight.
Coach says you want it tested.
I do.
He looked at Janie. You're willing?
Yes, Janie said, definitely.
Any idea who might do this? Petalini asked.
I'd start with Marvin Bell's niece, Bree said. If Sharon Lawrence would lie about a rape for him, she'd plant drugs for him.
The sheriff's detective pursed his lips, said, I'll talk to her. Meantime, take Janie to the office. I'll call ahead for someone to take the prints and blood.
Petalini walked off toward the other girls, who were acting annoyed that they weren't being allowed to leave.
Dad, Janie said as we stood up and got ready to leave, can you make sure I can still go down to Duke to train for the 400 on Saturday?
Meet you at the car, I said. I went over to Coach Green, asked her. She hesitated.
She's innocent until proven guilty, Coach.
You're right, and I'm sorry, Dr. Cross, she said. In all my years coaching, I've never had anything like this happen. Unless those tests say different, Janie can come run with us on Saturday and any other day she wants.
I turned to leave, started toward the tunnel beneath the stands. But Marvin Bell and his adopted son, Finn Davis, blocked the way.
We're such a big-time cop, you don't listen so well,
Marvin Bell said.
Yeah, I said. What did I miss?
Your niece brought up my name in court today,
Bell said.
Your niece was testifying in court today, I said.
That's bullshit, said Finn Davis.
It's bullshit that she was testifying or that she's Mr. Bell's niece.
Bell smiled sourly.
I warned you about besmirching my name in court.
Besmirching?
Slandering, whatever you want to call it,
Bell said. It's only slander or besmirching if it's not true, I said.
Davis said, Listen, Detective Asshole. That poor girl was raped by that sick fuck Stephen Tate. It took guts for her to go on that stand and face her rapist.
No argument there, I said.
Then quit trying to tear her down. You go on and think anything you want about me, but you leave Sharon out of it. She's a victim in all of this. And I won't have her made into a punching bag.
And I won't have someone try to frame my daughter in retaliation.
What the hell are you talking about?
Someone just put a vial of white powder in her gym bag, I said. That's a sheriff's detective out there investigating. I figure Sharon for the job.
Horseshit,
Bell said.
I took a step, got right in their faces, said, No, gentlemen. Horseshit is you trying to kill me and strong-arm my family. You're on notice. I am officially declaring war on the two of you.
Chapter 53.
Bree didn't say much on the ride home after we'd taken Janie to the sheriff's office, where she provided blood and urine for analysis. I asked for and received samples from the same specimens, a precaution. When we got home and went inside, I put the samples in a brown bag in the fridge. Janie started telling Nana Mama about everything that had happened. Ali lay on the couch,
watching another episode of Uncharted with Jim Shockey. "Where is he now?" I asked. Shockey had traded his cowboy hat for a bandana and was wading in murky water in a jungle. "Like the Congo?" "That Jim Shockey gets around," I said. "Bree come in?" "I'm out here," she called from the porch. I went out, found her sitting in a rocker, looking out through the screen. She wasn't happy. "We okay?" I asked. "Not really," she said quietly. "Why?" "Did you have to say that to Bell and Davis, that you were declaring war on them?" I was speaking from the heart. "I get that, Alex. But now you're more of a target than you were before." "Good," I said. "We draw them out and we shut them down." She looked up angrily. "Why do you always put yourself in harm's way?" My chin retreated. "Bree, you of all people should know that it's part of the job," she asked. "I don't think so. I don't put myself in harm's way intentionally, and you do all the time. Did you ever stop for a second and think that it's a pretty goddamn selfish habit?" "Selfish?" I said, bewildered. "Yes, selfish," Bree said. "You have a family that needs you. You have a wife that needs you. And yet at the drop of a hat, you're ready to risk our happiness and well-being." I was speechless for several moments. I'd never heard Bree talk like this before. My late wife. And Ali's mother, yes, but Bree, no. I hung my head and said, "What should I have done?" "Diffuse the situation," she said. "Make them think you're no threat until you got damning evidence against them. But it's too late. You escalated the threat, Alex, and Bree," I said, holding up my hands, "I get it. And I'm sorry." In my own defense, because Janny was being used, I got a little hot under the collar. "It won't happen again." "That's good to hear," she said, getting up from the rocker and going inside. "But you remain a target." I stood there a moment, feeling a weight that hadn't been there 10 minutes before. She was right. I had pushed when I should have been smarter and laid off. In the kitchen, Janny was finishing up a dinner of country-style ribs with Nana Mama. My grandmother studied me, said, "You in hot water?" "Trying to get out," I said, heaping rice on my plate and then helping myself to the ribs, which were falling off the bone and smelled incredible. "Thank you, Nana," Janny said, clearing her plate. "That was great." "Easy recipe," she said, waving off the compliment. "Orange juice and barbecue sauce, then slow cook them at 250 for 4 hours. "Still great," I said after taking a bite. Sitting down, I ate and watched Janny for any sign that she was anxious about the events of the past couple of hours. But she seemed confident when she left the kitchen. "Janny told me," Nana Mama said. "We took care of it," I said. "What was bothering you this morning?" Part of me wanted to tell her what my cousin had said, that her son had survived the fall from the bridge and the trip through the gorge and went on to live 2 years on the run before committing suicide. Instead, I said, "Just a rough night." "Uh-huh," my grandmother said, unconvinced, and left me to my dinner, which was remarkably good, even by Nana Mama's high standards. When I was done cleaning my plate, I went to our bedroom and found the door shut. I knocked, and Bree said, "It's open." I went in, shut the door. Bree sat on the bed, studying her laptop. In a low voice, I said, "I am sorry." She looked up and gave me a half-hearted smile. "I know you are. There's dinner waiting for you. Outstanding country ribs." "I'll go eat in a minute," she said. "I can't tell Nana Mama what Pinky told me," I said quietly. "Why not?" she asked. "I don't," I began and then rubbed at my temples. "I guess I don't want her to hear any of it unless I can prove it's all true." "Your Uncle Cliff is in no position to corroborate the story," Bree said. "I know," I said, and then saw how to solve two problems at once. So I'm getting up early, driving to Raleigh, and catching a plane to Palm Beach. "Okay," she said, confused. "Why?" "It's the closest airport to where my father killed himself.
I explained. And it gets me out of Starksville for a day or two, which eliminates me as a target. But what about Stefan? Despite what I said at the track practice, he could have been framed, maybe by Bell. Or Finn Davis, I said. Which is why you're going to be careful while I'm gone. Hang to the outside and learn everything you can from the public record about the two of them. Bree thought about that and then nodded. That I can do. Chapter 54. Palm Beach, Florida. Driven by a hot wind, the flames roared and belched black smoke into the late morning sky. White egrets circled in the smoke, feasting on clouds of bugs fleeing the fire. They were harvesting and burning sugarcane on both sides of Florida Route 441 as I headed west toward Lake Okeechobee, and twice I had to slow to a crawl. The smoke was so thick. Finally, I got upwind of the fire, and the smoke was gone. I saw the sign welcoming me to Bell Glade. It was where my father had killed himself, and as hard luck a place as I'd ever seen. I'd heard about the city, of course. Who in law enforcement hadn't? As a municipality, Bell Glade used to have a murder rate the equivalent of a big metro area like D.C. or Chicago. After 5 minutes in Bell Glade, I could see some of the reasons why. But I wasn't there to diagnose and solve social ills. So I ignored the empty buildings and storefronts pocked with bullet holes and relied on Google Maps to lead me to the various churches around town. I wanted to find out how my father came to kill himself behind one of them. There were a lot of churches in Bell Glade. At the first two, one for Baptists and another for Adventists, I got no helpful information. At St. Christopher's Catholic Church, I talked with a priest painting the rectory door. Father Richard Lane was in his 50s and had only recently been transferred to Bell Glade. 33 years ago, he said, squinting at me, I don't know how you're going to find someone just on a name. I believe in miracles, Father, I said. Well, I can check and see if a funeral mass was said for Mr. Brown here, but if the old records are as poorly maintained as the newer ones are, I can't offer you much hope, Detective Cross. I gave the priest my business card, told him to call if he found anything. Over the next 2 hours, I knocked on the doors of every other place of worship in town. Someone answered at every church, but no one knew of a Paul Brown committing suicide there years before. One evangelical minister recommended I try the churches in nearby towns to the north. Another advised me to do a county record search for death certificates. Both were good ideas, and as I left the second minister, I tried to figure out what to do next and how best to do it. It was beastly hot and humid, and I was eager to climb into my rental car and cool off in the air conditioning. But then I noticed a Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office van parked up and across the street next to one of those shabby apartment complexes with two floors and exterior stairs. I wandered over, looked into the complex, and saw a small crowd of people watching the upper floor where yellow crime tape had been strung up around the door of one of the apartments. A criminalist, a young guy, came down the stairs and started to walk past me. I held up my badge and identified myself before asking where I'd need to go to get someone with the sheriff's department to pull some documents for me as a professional courtesy. I honestly don't know, the tech said. Sergeant Drummond might. Where's Sergeant Drummond? I asked. That's him, the criminalist said, gesturing to two men dressed in suits exiting the apartment. The one with the face scar. One of the men was big, African-American, older, 60s. The other was in his 30s, dark good looks, and judging from his physique, a power lifter. My bet was on the lifter for the face scar, though I can't tell you why. But when the older detective turned to climb down the stairs, I saw the large patch of ragged skin that began beneath his right eye, ran down 7 inches, and then looped back above the jaw toward his ear. Sergeant Drummond, I said, holding up my badge. Detective Alex Cross with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, Homicide Division. Drummond's face was flat as he examined my credentials. Okay. The younger detective grinned and stuck out his hand. Detective Richard S. Johnson. I know who you are, Dr. Cross. You used to be FBI, right?
I saw one of your Quantico lectures on tape. Sergeant, haven't you heard of Alex Cross?
Drummond handed me back my badge and said, I hope it doesn't crush your ego that I haven't.
Unlikely, Sergeant, I said, smiling. I have a pretty bomb-proof ego.
So how can we help? Detective Johnson said. You down here tracking some serial killer or something?
No, nothing like that, I said. And I explained that I was looking for a long-lost relative who supposedly died in Belglade years before.
We can do a search for you back at the office, Johnson offered.
Can we now? Sergeant Drummond asked. Or do we need to figure out who killed Francie Letourneau and two Palm Beach socialites?
I don't want to mess up your investigation, I said. Just point me in the right direction. I'll do the legwork.
Drummond shrugged.
Follow us back to the office and we'll see what we can do.
And maybe you'd want to take a look at our case, Johnson said.
Detective, Drummond growled. What, Sarge? His junior partner shot back. This guy's the expert's expert. He trains FBI agents, for Christ's sake.
Used to, I said, and I'd be glad to help, but if it would crush your ego.
The sergeant actually smiled, said,
What the hell, Dr. Cross, maybe you can teach an old dog new tricks.
Chapter 55. I followed them back to their offices in West Palm, a typical bullpen with cubicles surrounded by other cubicles that had windows and doors. Those were for the commanding officers, including Drummond.
Johnson, help him find what he's looking for, Drummond said. Sorry I can't give you the royal treatment you seem to deserve, Cross, but duty calls. I've got to make some phone calls, and I'll get those murder books for you.
Thank you, Sergeant, I said. He disappeared into his office and shut the door behind him.
While Johnson went to get us coffee, I sat there, listening to the familiar sounds of a homicide unit. Detectives on the phone, others in discussion. I hadn't been gone a week and already I missed it.
Johnson returned with two cups of decent coffee. I can't believe Alex Cross is sitting at my desk.
I stood up. Sorry.
What? No, sit down. It's an honor.
Now, what or who are we looking for?
Male, African-American, died roughly 33 years ago.
Johnson turned all business, got another chair, and retrieved his laptop computer.
Name?
Paul Brown. Supposedly killed himself behind a church in Belglade.
I'll look at county death records and see if he had a sheet with us.
You have digital back that far?
For all of Florida, Johnson said as he typed.
State paid for it. Prescient, you ask me.
I liked the young detective. He was sharp and full of energy.
I didn't know exactly what to think of Drummond, other than he had a dry wit.
So what's with Drummond's scar? I asked.
Johnson looked up.
First Gulf War. An oil well he was securing blew, killed two of his men.
Shrapnel laid his cheek open like a flap, burned and chewed it all up. Extensive nerve damage. It's why he hardly ever has any expression. His face just sort of hangs there, right?
You like him?
Johnson smiled.
Like?
I don't know yet, but I admire him. Drummond's the real deal in my book.
Good enough for me, I said.
Paul Brown?
Correct.
And 33 years ago?
Johnson said, studying his screen and typing.
We'll go plus or minus a year just to be safe. We have a date of birth?
I told him my father's birthday.
Johnson hit enter. Almost immediately, he shook his head. No match.
Leave the birthday blank, I said, figuring that my father must have been smart enough to leave everything about his old identity behind.
The detective played with it and hit enter again.
There you go. Three of them.
Three? I said, getting out of my chair to look at the screen.
Sure enough, three men named Paul Brown had died in Florida around 33 years ago.
Can you pull up the death certificates? I asked.
Just then, Sergeant Drummond exited his office, carrying several large black binders.
Any luck?
We got three Paul Browns, Johnson said. Is there a way to access the death certificates from Vital Statistics, Sarge?
Miami, what are you, 30 years younger than me?
You're supposed to be the technologically advanced part of the team.
The detective shook his head.
I don't.
Try clicking on the name, Drummond said.
Oh, Johnson said, and he clicked the first one. The screen jumped to a PDF image of a death certificate for Paul L. Brown of Pensacola, age 22. Cause of death? Blunt force trauma. Too young, I said. Try the next one. Johnson clicked on it. A new death certificate popped up for Paul Brown of Fort Lauderdale, age 79. Cause of death? Stroke. Too old, I said, now desperately wanting to find the answer behind door number 3. The third certificate fit the profile. Paul Brown of Pahokee, Florida, age 32, indigent. Cause of death? Self-inflicted gunshot wound. That's him, I said, with a sinking feeling. Where's Pahokee? Drummond said,
15 miles north of Belleglade.
It's got to be him, then, I said, studying the certificate oddly detached, which means the church is probably there.
Says here the body was released to Belcher Brothers' funeral home for interment.
Interment, Johnson said. Most indigents are cremated in Florida. Not this time, apparently, I said.
The sergeant said, I know the guys who own the funeral home, the Belchers. They run an ambulance service there, too. When I was on patrol in the west part of the county, they'd show up at all the fatalities. I'll make a call.
I'd appreciate that, Sergeant Drummond. Drummond nodded, gestured to the books.
There's the murders we're working on. We'd appreciate the third eyeball if you have the time.
The sergeant returned to his office. I started scanning the files on the deaths of the socialites Lisa Martin and Ruth Abrams, and their maid, Francie Letourneau. 2 hours later, I was almost finished and flipping my way through the appendix of reports on the cleaning woman when Drummond returned.
Took a bit to get in touch with him, but Raymond Belcher's working night duty, and he said he'd go through the files for you, the sergeant said.
Thanks, I said. Johnson returned to the cubicle with more coffee. I waved it off, said,
any more of that without something to eat and I'll get an ulcer.
Drummond said, you find anything in there?
I saw a few things.
What do you like to eat?
Anything. Seafood?
The sergeant nodded.
Got just the place, down in Lake Worth. Johnson, are you in?
We can talk about our case over dinner.
Absolutely, Johnson said. My wife's pregnant. Let me just call her.
Pregnant? Drummond said. You didn't tell me that.
Still early, Sarge, Johnson said, digging out his phone and walking away. End of the first trimester. Twins.
The sergeant frowned, looked at me. I would have liked to learn that sooner.
It matter? I asked.
Of course it matters, Drummond grumbled. As it stands now, I will do everything I can to keep Detective Johnson from screwing himself into harm's way and depriving those babies of their father.
You're a man of hidden virtue, Sergeant, I said. He looked at me with that slack, scarred face, said,
that's not virtue. Just common sense. It's just me and my wife, and she's got a good job that pays better than mine. But Johnson's got 3 people depending on him now. Do the math. Tell me where my priorities should be when the shit hits the fan.
Crusty as he was, Sergeant Drummond was beginning to grow on me.
Chapter 56. Pleasant Lake, North Carolina.
Pinky Parks gestured through the windshield to a gravel lane ahead that cut off the highway and dropped steeply to the lake.
There it is.
Bree pulled the blue Ford Taurus she'd rented that morning over onto the shoulder and put it in park.
Not much to see from here, Pinky said. You'd want to be in the woods.
Bree picked up a pair of binoculars and said, then let's go into the woods.
Once Pinky learned that Alex had gone to Florida and that Bree was focusing on Marvin Bell and Finn Davis, he'd insisted on helping her. But now he raised his eyebrow, said,
you looking to kick a hornet's nest?
She frowned. These woods are known for hornets?
These woods are known for Marvin Bell and Finn Davis, which is the same thing way I see it.
Suit yourself, Bree said, opening the door. I'll be back. Pinky groaned but got out as well. It was hazy, hot, and humid. They waited until traffic died and then cut down the steep embankment and entered a thorny raspberry thicket. Pinky led the way, clawing through it until they emerged into piney woods where crickets were sawing.
Below them, and out several hundred yards, Bree could see the clean waters of Pleasant Lake. She heard outboard motors and kids laughing. Pinky went down a game path that led through the trees, growing on the slope above the lake's eastern shore. Bree followed, her brain going back to everything they'd learned that morning about Marvin Bell and Finn Davis. After renting the car, she and Pinky had gone to the Stark County Recorder's office and gotten online with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office, looking into the two men's business interests. Together and individually, Bell and Davis owned five businesses in and around Starksville: a liquor store, a dry cleaning shop, two automated car washes, and a pawn and loan operation. Pinky smartly noted that all five businesses would generate and bring in a lot of cash. Convenient if you're also involved in some sort of illegal cash-intensive business. But Bree had zero jurisdiction here. She couldn't get to databases that might give her a look at the business's bank accounts. On a whim, Bree accessed public databases in Nevada and Delaware, because both states had incorporation and tax laws that made them attractive for people interested in creating shell companies. Though there was nothing in Nevada, she was pleased to find that Marvin Bell and Finn Davis were listed as registered agents of six Delaware companies, three apiece. All six corporations had been organized for the purpose of real estate acquisition and development, which in a roundabout way led Bree to look up their real estate holdings in Stark County. To her and Pinky's surprise, neither man appeared to own any property in the area. Pinky said that simply wasn't true, that Bell owned all sorts of property in Stark County, beginning with an estate on Pleasant Lake. When they looked up the lakefront property, they found it was owned by one of Marvin Bell's Delaware companies and carried an assessed value of $3.1 million, which made Bree want to see the place. Alex had told her to hang back, to stay to the outside, but Bree wasn't planning to climb over the fence Marvin Bell had around his compound. She just wanted to look over it, get a sense of how the man lived. Pinky motioned to Bree to stop. She did, next to a young, fat pine tree that smelled of sap and blocked her view of the lake. Looking over his shoulder, Pinky whispered, "If you get low, slide around in front of me and stay in the shadows. You should get a good look at it without being seen." Bree got down on her hands and knees. Pinky pressed into the wall of pines there and let her pass. She twisted into a sitting position and used her feet to scoot herself sideways out into a shadowy slot in the trees. 100 vertical feet below Bree, and 100 yards closer to the lake, was the gravel lane and the gate, which was tall, 10 feet anyway, and the chain-link fence was shrink-wrapped in green vinyl. Bree swept the binoculars along the top of the fence, making out coiled razor wire that had also been shrink-wrapped green. Tiny cameras were mounted on posts to either side of the gate. There were other cameras on posts every 40 yards or so before the fence was swallowed by dense vegetation. She assumed the cameras continued on around the 6-acre perimeter and turned her attention to the compound. Rhododendrons had been planted along the interior of the fence, no doubt to block the view from the gravel lane. But this high above the fence and the bushes, Bree had close to a bird's-eye view of Marvin Bell's domain, which featured a small lagoon at her left and a blunt point of flatland that jutted out into the main lake. Set back from the point on a knoll to the right of the lagoon and facing the lake stood the main house, a 10,000-square-foot log mansion with a red steel roof and matching shutters. A beautiful stone terrace with gardens above the lagoon complemented the house. Three stone walkways flared out from a second terrace in front of the mansion, one going to the point, one to a boathouse to the left of the point, and one to a 6-bay dock system to the right, with lifts that held a fleet of sea-doos, motorboats, canoes, and sailboats. There was a bar and a huge barbecue built right into the dock, along with lounge chairs and umbrellas. Out on the point itself stood a miniature version of the main house, from which Bree imagined the views must be incredible. She could see through several of the large and dramatic windows into the main building and could tell no expense had been spared on the interior. And there was art everywhere, paintings, sculptures, and mobiles.
The place looked like it was worth $3.1 million, no doubt, which raised her suspicions even further. In Bree's mind, owning some small businesses in Starksville, North Carolina, did not get you a home worth upwards of $3 million. She supposed Bell could have been successful in the stock market, or maybe one of those Delaware real estate investment companies had gone large. But if so, why would Marvin Bell stay here? The property looked like a little piece of heaven, she admitted, but didn't people who hit big money like to show it off in more trendy places? Maybe Marvin Bell was just a homebody, like Warren Buffett. Or maybe he had a reason to stay here despite the wealth. Maybe he had crucial business to attend to. Before she could weigh those options, Bree caught motion and swung the binoculars to see Finn Davis exiting the mansion. The rest of the estate was quiet and empty. The only sounds, kids laughing. A distant outboard motor came from well down the shore. Wearing dark sunglasses, a dirty ball cap, a green work shirt, jeans, and heavy boots, Finn Davis moved in an easy saunter around the circular driveway to a 5-bay log garage. He pressed a remote control. A door raised, revealing an old orange and white Ford Bronco. Where was he going in that heap? Looked totally out of place on... Bree rolled out of her sitting position, scooted back behind the pines, and jumped up. We have to get back to the car, she whispered to Pinky. Fast! Chapter 57 Lake Worth, Florida. Detective Sergeant Drummond parked outside the Kurzman Caribbean restaurant, and the three of us went in. Althea, the owner and cook, saw Drummond and rushed out from behind a counter to hug him, laughing. You leave your old lady for me yet, Drummond? Althea asked in a Jamaican accent. You know she's one in a million, the sergeant replied. I do, Althea said. Just checking to see if you lost your mind since I last saw you. Drummond introduced us, and she found us a seat in the small restaurant. Something to drink? Althea asked. Red Stripe. Johnson looked at Drummond, who said, You off duty, don't mind me. Red Stripe, Johnson said. Make it two, I said. Drummond said, Don't bother with menus, Althea. Just bring us what you think we should be eating. Some of it should be fish. That seemed to make her happy, and she went off. You'll be ruined for Jamaican food for life, Drummond said. I'm not kidding. Half the customers are from the Caribbean. I won't be able to tell my wife, I said. She loves Jamaica. Me too. Yeah, Drummond said. I'm fond of it myself. I looked at Johnson, wanting to include him. You ready to be a dad, detective? I don't know. Were you? Drummond asked me. Ready? No, I said. All I knew was I didn't want to be like my father. That work out? Pretty much, I said, and turned back to Johnson. Don't worry, you just sort of grow into the job day by day. The beers came, so did small bowls of what Althea called fish tea, which was delicious, along with a basket of fresh zucchini bread, which was also delicious. No way I was telling Bree about this place. So did you see anything we missed, Dr. Cross? Johnson asked. Call me Alex, I said, and I don't think you missed anything, but there are a few things I'm not clear on, and a few things you might consider. Okay, Drummond said. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, I said. You've got Lisa Martin and Ruth Abrams, wealthy socialites killed within a week of each other and made to look like suicides. That's right, Johnson said. Friends? Apparently so, the sergeant said. Beyond that, they shared the same maid, Francie Letourneau, who stole jewelry from both women before being murdered herself. Correct, Johnson said. We got confirmation from the husbands on pictures we showed them of several jewelry pieces found at Francie's apartment. Francie told the bar owner in Belglade. Althea returned with a tray. Fried plantains, rice and black beans, oxtail stew, and a whole steamed and spiced grouper. Definitely not telling Bree. We dug in. The oxtail was simply incredible. So was the grouper. So were the second and third red stripes. I'd forgotten how easily they go down. Once we were into second helpings, I said, Francie told the bar owner in the Glade she was coming to Palm Beach for a job interview the day she died.
That's right, Drummond said.
Only we haven't found a damn thing to say she ever made it to Palm. She just disappears.
No phone calls? Her cell phone's missing, but we found the account, Johnson said. I made a request yesterday for all calls in the last 3 months. We'll probably hear tomorrow sometime.
Other thoughts? Drummond asked.
Yes, I think you should focus on the links and chains between the victims and extrapolate from there.
Johnson looked confused, so I said, you want to isolate each thing that connects them, so say, focus first on Francie as the common denominator link in what we'll call the socialites chain. Under this scenario, the maid could have killed them both to rip off their jewelry and then was killed herself by a third party who got wind of the jewels she was holding.
I could see that, Drummond said, dishing a third helping of oxtail onto his plate.
What's the second link? Johnson asked. Or chain.
The socialite friendship, I said.
Maybe Francie was working for a third socialite, was in the process of robbing her, and someone caught her, killed her, dumped her.
Johnson shook his head.
From the files I went through at her apartment, Francie had been on hard times, lost all of her cleaning jobs.
Before she hit the lotto?
Correct.
So maybe there was no lotto hit, I said.
Maybe the jewels were the explanation behind the newfound money. And maybe she wasn't going to Palm Beach for an interview on the day she died. Maybe she was going to kill someone and steal more jewels.
Chapter 58.
Sergeant Drummond thought about that, said, we'll call a lotto.
I'd be calling past clients, too, I said. See if any of them are missing jewelry. I mean, there were jewelry pieces the Abramsons and Martins couldn't identify in your photographs, right?
True, Johnson said between mouthfuls.
Drummond's cell phone rang. He pulled it out, looked at it, said,
sorry, gentlemen, but I have to take this.
He got up, leaving me with Johnson, who said, there's another possibility, you know.
Go ahead, I said.
Maybe Francie was the jewel thief, but she wasn't the killer. The young detective said, maybe she went to rob someone and surprise the killer.
You mean in the act of trying to murder a third socialite?
Why not?
Any reports of assaulted socialites?
Not that I know of, Johnson said.
Dessert, Althea came over and said.
I'm stuffed, I said.
She frowned at me, said, I make it from scratch. I held up my hands.
I'll make room.
Sweet potato pudding, she said, smiling. Coffee, tea?
I'll take a coffee, I said.
I will too, Althea, said Drummond, sliding back into his chair.
I have to be going, Johnson said. Can we get the check?
Don't worry about it, Drummond said. I got you both covered.
Let me take my part of it, I said.
Visiting dignitary, I don't think so,
the sergeant sniffed. Johnson got up, said, again, it was great meeting you, Alex.
Likewise, I said, getting to my feet and shaking his hand.
See you in the morning, Sarge.
Bright and early, Drummond grumbled.
Our coffee and pudding came.
I didn't know sweet potato pudding could be decadent, but it was.
The sergeant took a sip of coffee, said,
so all we've been doing is talking about our case. What is someone like you working on these days?
I hesitated, then started telling him about my cousin Stefan and Starksville and all the strange twists the case had taken in the few days we'd been there. Through it all, Drummond listened intently and quietly, sipping his coffee and eating pudding. It took me the better part of an hour to tell it all, and with the beers in me, I probably said more than I should have. But Drummond was a good listener, and it just seemed natural.
And that's where we are, I said.
After several beats, the sergeant said,
you like this guy Marvin Bell for killing that kid, but I don't hear anything that says you got him involved.
Because we don't have him involved, I said. Like everyone in Starksville says, he's a slippery guy.